Sounds True presents The Science of Enlightenment with Shinzen Young.
In the sciences, a very common strategy is to take a complex phenomenon and break it down into natural components. That often allows us to understand that complex phenomenon at a deeper level, and also to be able to work with that complex phenomenon, to be able to have some control over it or predict things about it. One very complex phenomenon that is important for us human beings, in fact centrally important for us human beings, is none other than the phenomenon of our experience. Experience is quite complex. However, there is a natural way that we can analyze any experience into much simpler components. When we are able to look at an experience in terms of these simpler components, we discover that our experience is much easier to understand and much more manageable. The six natural components out of which any experience is built are none other than our six senses. Any experience that we're likely to have will involve one or several of our six senses, or perhaps a subset, a particular aspect of one of the six senses. In the West, we tend to think that there are five senses, but in the Buddhist theory of consciousness, they talk about six, and I think it's an extremely useful formulation. The six senses are hearing, seeing, smelling, and tasting. Those four are pretty easy to understand. The other two senses require some comment. The other two senses are the feeling body and the thinking mind. So, according to the Buddhist consciousness, each experience will in some way involve some combination of hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, feeling in the body, and thoughts in the mind. In the English language, there is a lot of confusion between the feeling process and the thinking process. When a person tells us they're going to share their feelings, are they going to describe tangible sensation that they're going through in their body? Are they going to say, when I'm around you, I feel a tense quality in my solar plexus and a shaky quality in my arms and a hot quality going over my face? No. When they say they're going to share their feelings with you, they're going to say, this is why I'm pissed off at you. This is what I don't like about you. This has to be changed. What they're actually sharing, of course, is their concepts, their ideas. According to the Buddhist formulation, the feeling process is equivalent to body sensation. The thinking process is quite distinct from that, although the two usually arise simultaneously, and that no doubt is one of the reasons why there's so much confusion. Let's look at thought first. We can look at thought in terms of types of thoughts that we have. Some of our thoughts are remembering thoughts, recalling things from the past. Some of our thoughts are judging thoughts. I like this, I don't like that. This is what I like about myself, this is what I don't like about myself. This is what I like about others, don't like about others. Some of our thoughts are planning. There's all sorts of planning that constantly goes on during the day. Big time planning for large scale, but also moment by moment, what am I going to say to this person? How am I going to respond to this? Some of our thoughts are believing thoughts. convictions. This is the way it is. This is the way it's always been. This is the way it always will be. This is the way I am. This is the way they are. Convictions, beliefs, this is the nature of reality, etc., etc. Some of our thoughts are worrying thoughts. That's a common thought mode. Memory, planning, judging, believing. And of course, there's a lot of fantasizing thoughts. These are some of the categories of thought. Another way to categorize thought is to look at it in terms of the thinking process, how the thought comes to us. If you look very carefully, you'll see that most of the thoughts that you're consciously aware of come either as internal conversations or internal imagery. You will find that you're thinking in words, phrases, sentences, paragraphs, sometimes chapters, whole books. Okay. But it is words. If you speak more than one language and you look carefully, you may find that sometimes it's the words in one of those languages, sometimes it's the words in the other language. But it's definitely grammatical human speech. Sometimes it's your own voice that you hear. Sometimes it's other people's voices. Sometimes it's a dialogue. Sometimes it's a monologue. But it is a kind of internal talking. So this is one mode of the thinking process. Another mode of the thinking process is imaging. We see in the mind's eye vague forms. We see scenes, faces, situations, spatial relationships. It's very much like the things we see in the external world, but a little bit more nebulous usually, and usually semi-transparent, perhaps fleeting. But we have things going on essentially on an internal screen of the mind. Some people think more in the internal talking mode. Some people think more in the internal imaging mode. Often both are present. This is how thought presents itself to us. There is plenty of thinking that goes on that is not clearly words and phrases or images and pictures. It's a more subtle kind of thinking. Most people aren't aware of that subtle processing. The conscious thought that you're likely to be aware of at the beginning is the talking and imaging aspect. But after you've meditated for a little while, you become aware that there's a kind of background processing that's constantly going on. You can't pin it down as to it being words or images, and you can't really even pin it down very much in terms of what it means, but it's sort of like a background hum. The wheels are turning deep down. What I strongly suspect is that it's exceedingly fleeting and subtle talking and imaging, largely, but it's massively parallel, and it's so fast and so fleeting, and so much of it is going on at the same time that we can never really discern the individual meanings there. It's sort of like when the blades of a propeller move fast, you can't see the blades. All you see is a general sense of movement. And I like to call that kind of thinking subtle processing. And as I say, that subtle processing is constantly going on. Literally thousands and thousands of associations are happening deep down for you to be able to process these words as you now hear them. So as you're listening to these words, you might reflect back your reactions to what you hear me say. To what extent are you thinking in terms of image? To what extent are you thinking in terms of a commentary going on in your internal ear? And to what extent is it a more subtle sort of undercurrent or subterranean processing that is going on in response to the words that you now hear? So by the thinking process, we mean internal images, internal conversations, and any more subtle subconscious rapid processings that may be going on. That thinking process is really quite distinct from the feeling process, because the feeling process, as I say, is equivalent to the pleasures and pains and neutral sensations that we have in the body. If you want to keep track of the thinking process, one way to keep track of it is in terms of the types of thoughts: planning, fantasizing, judging, remembering, believing, etc. Another way to keep track of your thinking process, to clarify the thinking process, is to be aware moment by moment of the mode in which you're thinking. Is it image? Is it words? Is it subtle processing? Is it a combination of those? The ability to keep track of the distinct components of one's experience is extremely important. First of all, that ability allows one to be with what is, to know for sure just what's going on. But secondly, that ability to keep track of the components of one's experience allows one to penetrate into the subcomponents of the components and then into the sub-subcomponents until one can get down to the ultimate building blocks, the ultimate substance that underlies all experience. And this ability to keep track of the components, subcomponents, sub-subcomponents that constitute any given experience is called, in the Buddhist tradition, mindfulness. The Pali word is sati, S-A-T-I. The essence of mindfulness is to keep track, to make discernment with respect to the components. And there's another word in Pali, vipassana. Vi means separate or distinct, and passana means to see or perceive. So to be able to see distinctly exactly what's going on is the practice of vipassana, or mindfulness meditation. Just as the thinking process can be looked upon in terms of talking, imaging, subtle processing, the feeling process in the body has various dimensions to it. One dimension of feeling is the quality of the feeling. Hot feels different from cold. Pressure feels different from itch. Embarrassment feels different from anger. Anger feels different from fear. Fear feels different from sadness. Sadness feels different from burn. Burn feels different from cut. And they all feel different from the touch of your clothes. And all of those feel quite different from the sensation of the blood circulating, or the breathing process, or tiredness, or being very alert and having energy. Tired is a sensation. Sleepy is a quality of sensation. Boredom has with it a quality of body sensation. Impatience has associated with it a quality of body sensation. Even confusion, which is a mental event, has associated with it a quality of body sensation. There are many flavors or qualities of body sensation. However, those flavors are not infinite. There are just many. How many? Well, I suppose perceptual psychologists could get into rather lengthy discussions about how many and what are basic. But I would say, just based on my own experience, there can't be more than a couple dozen. A half dozen or so are real major and significant. There's basically only a handful of flavors or qualities that we need to become intimate with and to experience fully. And once we've experienced these fully, we have pretty much completed the feeling process. On the spiritual path, one has to learn how to have a complete experience of anger, so that anger does not cause suffering and therefore distort our behavior. One has to learn how to have a complete experience of fear for the same reason, sadness for the same reason. One has to come to be able to have complete experience of physical pain, fatigue and tiredness. These are a few of the basic ones that a person has to come to have a complete experience of. There are also plenty of pleasant sensations, the deep relaxation and bliss associated with meditation has to also become an object of meditation so that we can have a complete experience of that. And of course, erotic sensation, sexual sensation, that's another major human flavor or quality of sensation. We have to come to the place, if we want to be complete beings, where we know how to have complete experience of sexual erotic sensations. So one dimension of feeling is its quality. A second dimension of feeling is its intensity. Anything from a mild irritation to homicidal rage is really within the anger family. It's the same basic quality or flavor, just greater intensity levels that constitute that range. Likewise, anything from a little bit of anticipation to paralytic terror. These are all examples of the, quote, fear flavor, but at different intensities. Sensations or feelings in the body can differ in quality. They can differ in intensity. Another dimension of feeling is that it has location and shape and spatial distribution. Once one understands that feeling equals body sensation, then one could start to talk about the location of a feeling, the shape of a feeling, how a feeling may have its primary location in one part of the body and spread more subtle influences through the whole rest of the body, so that there's a whole configuration of distribution of quality and intensity throughout the body associated with that feeling. Most people do not equate feeling and body sensation. This is because most people are so centered in the thinking process that they don't pay much attention to the body. There's not much precision or contact with respect to what's actually happening in the body, because they're so preoccupied with the other sense gate, the thinking process. For the adult human being, the center is the thinking process. For a baby or an animal, the center is the feeling process in the body. We get a perception that somehow our feelings are in our mind. As you meditate and you start to have experiences of the mind becoming still, the thinking process becoming still, you can see clearly that what's left after the thinking process becomes still, after the images and internal conversations cease, you still have feeling. In fact, you're really in contact with feeling. You're left with a feeling body. As I like to use the word emotion, and of course it's just my personal choice in how words are going to be used, for me, emotion is a tangling together of certain kinds of thoughts and certain kinds of body sensations. That's emotion in the sense of subjective experience. Emotion is unfortunately a very ambiguous word because it can also refer to our objective expression. In terms of the subjective aspect of experience, for me, emotion comes about through a tangling together of ideas in the mind and feelings in the body. It turns out that the ability to make feeling tangible by working with it through body sensation is extremely useful. Eventually, through practice, we can develop what may be one of the two or three most fundamental skills that any human being can acquire, which I call skill at feeling. It's a skill that not only did they not teach you in school, they never talked about. But once feeling, be it either emotional in origin, physiological in origin, or purely physical and mechanical, once feeling can be made tangible in terms of body sensation, then we have at least the potential of being able to experience feeling completely. Skill at feeling is the ability to greet feeling with the qualities of mindfulness and equanimity. Mindfulness, I've already defined. It is the ability in real time, moment by moment, of keeping track of the components, subcomponents, sub-subcomponents of some aspect of experience. And equanimity is a non-interference with the natural movements of the experience, the natural movements of the components of experience. Equanimity, in terms of what we cultivate, involves a kind of relaxation, on one hand, a relaxation of the body, a non-tensing and tightening in the body. It also involves a kind of dropping of judgments in the conscious mind. So the equanimity that we cultivate consciously has two aspects to it, a body aspect, which is keep the body as relaxed as we can, and a mental aspect, which is don't hold on to judgments in the mind as best we can. There's a deeper kind of equanimity, which is not something that we consciously cultivate, but which just happens to us as we continue to work over time. And that's equanimity in the sense of a letting go of moment by moment congealing or interference with the natural movement qualities of the senses in general, and specifically the feeling sense in the body. Because feeling in the body has the aspects that I talked about, it has quality, there are various qualities or flavors, there are various intensities, various spatial distributions. Mindfulness would mean to keep track of what the qualities are, what their intensities are, and how they're distributed through the body moment by moment. If one is able to do this, the body becomes a three-dimensional, high-resolution viewing screen upon which we can see moment by moment our entire feeling life, the feeling core of our being, expressed. Once we can do this, we can begin to detect in what ways the feelings want to move and change. In terms of their spatial location, do they want to shift over here, shift over there? In terms of their shape, do they want to push out here or pull in there? In terms of their intensity, do they want to get stronger, get weaker? In terms of the qualities, does it want to change? Does the itch want to become a burn? Does the burn want to become a stab? Does the stab want to become a pressure, etc.? With experience, we become intimate with the ways in which feeling wants to move within the body. Then we can begin to open up at a very deep level and allow that to happen. Of course, when we allow the natural movement of feeling to take place within the body, we're unblocking the feeling process. Another definition of equanimity is radical permission to feel. And it turns out that when the pleasant feelings are allowed to flow, they produce deeper satisfaction. When the unpleasant feelings are allowed to flow, they produce diminished suffering. So that skill at feeling means to become a person of complete feeling, but it also means to become a person whose base level of fulfillment is much higher than the average and whose base level of suffering is much lower than the average. So although it requires work, the payoff is more than worth it. The first step in working skillfully with feeling is to be able to discern at any given moment how many qualities of feeling may be present. There may just be one feeling, maybe it's neutral, or there may be two or three flavors present, or more. I once had an experience helping one of my students die. He was a very interesting person. He was sort of a colorful character. He had been a sea captain. I called him Popeye. He really looked like Popeye the Sailor Man, and he was really tough. In fact, tough enough to scare me. He'd been torpedoed during World War II twice and survived, you know, having the ship blown out from under him. And he was one of these kinds of guys that would get in fights on docks and wipe out four other guys and throw them into the ocean, you know. He was a really tough character. When he first came to me, I was standing outside of this temple where I was living, and this was in an area where there were many Buddhist practice centers in this neighborhood. We used to call it the Buddhist Ghetto in Los Angeles. And he came up to me and he introduced himself. He said, "I'm looking for a Buddhist center to practice at. I've been staying at the Korean Zen center down the street. I just got pissed off at the head monk and I just cold cocked him and they're kicking me out. Would you be willing to let me in here?" I don't know why we let him in, but we did. And it turned out that he turned into a very devoted practitioner and meditated with me for about 5-6 years, got quite skillful in meditation, but they diagnosed him with lung cancer, and it was time to die, and he knew it, and he wanted to really do it well. He invited me out to Tulsa, where he was staying. I stayed with him as he was going through this process. It turns out he didn't die quite as quickly as he thought he was going to, and I had to leave. I couldn't be with him for the whole thing. When I left, he asked me what was my final advice to him, how to use this experience. I said, "Well, it seems to me that you've got 5 qualities of sensation, based on what I see, 5 different flavors. There is a kind of pain from the tumor. There is exhaustion, because you can't sleep very well. There is nausea, which is another distinct quality of sensation. There's a bit of irritability, and there's some fear present." And he said, "Yeah, you're exactly right. That's exactly what I'm experiencing." So I said, "Your job is straightforward. Never lose track of these 5 qualities of sensation, whichever one or combination of them is arising. Be precise about where they are in the body, where their primary location is, and how they spread and influence more broadly through the body. And keep infusing them with mindfulness and equanimity, allowing them to get intense or mild, allowing them to shift and spread, expand out, contract in, whatever. And that's basically it. And as a result of that, your suffering will be reduced. This will be a good experience for you, not a bad one." He, in point of fact, was able to do that. He had enough experience in meditation to understand the instruction and to implement them. And indeed, it wasn't a bad experience for him. It was a good experience. What he started to experience was not only, of course, a reduction in suffering, because he was keeping track of what was going on. If he was unable to keep track of each of those distinctly, if each caused 10 units of pain, he would have 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10, 10 to the fifth, which is 100,000 units of suffering. But because he was able to keep track of all of that, he had 10 plus 10 plus 10 plus 50. So that's a vast, vast reduction in the amount of suffering. But it was more than that. He started to identify the different flavors of sensation with purifying away different aspects of his former karma from his wild life and the things he'd done and the way he'd treated people and the way he had treated his family. I was talking to him once, and he said, "I have to go, excuse me for a minute," and I heard him barfing, you know, into the toilet. He came back and he said, "Joe, I just worked through a big piece about me and my son with that nausea that I just experienced." You could actually feel the different flavors as he infused them with mindfulness and equanimity, sort of reaching down into different aspects of the memory banks where the karma or the guilt was stored and cleaning it out. The exhaustion cleaned him out in one way. The fear cleaned him out in another way as he was able to keep track and let it move and circulate, whatever. And in fact, an amazing thing happened while I was working with him. I got this call from another student of mine who was totally freaked, absolutely terrified. He literally had just come back from the doctor, and they found the proverbial tumor the size of a basketball in his stomach. This was a fellow that actually is a fairly known producer of comedy scripts and things, a movie producer. And he was freaked. It looked like a death sentence for sure. Actually, it turned out they were able to successfully remove this tumor, much to everybody's surprise, but there was no way to think that that's how it was going to end that day. Here I had the guy dying of cancer, and this other guy who, I said he was a student, but he never had enough discipline to really meditate. He would just come and listen to talks, okay? Needless to say, he was really freaked. He had no resources. So I got the student that was dying. I just put him right on the phone, right then and there, and said, "This is the story. Help this guy out. He just found out he's going to die horribly. You are dying this way. Help him out. Tell him about it." And he did. He told him about it. And it was just an amazing thing to see. It helped. Because it's one thing for me to say, you know, well, theoretically, you don't have to suffer and some good things are going to happen, yeah, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's, you know, a cruel irony if somebody tries to tell you that in your moment of greatest abject terror. But to have somebody in between barfing into the toilet who is now dying of cancer talk to you in that vein, well, that's a little more impactful. In any event, the job is to keep track, first, of the flavors. They may not be horrible, painful flavors. They may be different kinds of pleasure or mixture of pleasure and pain, mixture of physical versus emotional qualities. What are the qualities? Where are they centered? Typically, a sensation will have an area of high intensity, and then it will spread an influence, perhaps very, very subtly, through much or all of the body. And that subtle spread or global impact of a sensation is often difficult to detect, but it is really important. Because just as most of the action in the tree is in the leaves, they're light, but there are a lot of them, so most of the action in a feeling is in the subtle ramifications that spread out from the obvious primary locations. Once you are aware of what the qualities are, what the primary locations are, what sort of impact spreads from those locations, then what? Then infuse all that with equanimity. Just accept it as it is to the best of your ability. So one skill at feeling involves bringing the quality of mindfulness, which is this precision, and the quality of equanimity, which is this allowing or openness, to the feeling state. In a sense, that's all one does. That with time, insight and purification arise as the result of that. Insight means you come to understand the feeling process in a new way. You understand things like suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance. You understand things like spiritual purification equals pain multiplied by equanimity. You understand things like fulfillment equals pleasure divided by grasping. You understand things like spiritual purification equals pleasure multiplied by equanimity. Those are insights that arise with time as you observe the feeling process. I think you can understand those insights as concepts expressed in words, but of course it's really something quite different to directly experience those insights within the reality of your own body. I express it and explain it to you in words now. That's reading the textbook, but any science course you take, you have two parts. There's the lecture and there's the lab work. So I'm giving you the lecture now. That's conceptual. The lab work, you have to go look through your own microscope and see, yeah, the pain is one thing. The interference with the pain is something else. When they come together, there's the pressure called suffering. But when there's just the pain, there's just the pain. It performs all of the useful functions of pain. It informs. It motivates. But it lacks the problems associated with pain. It doesn't block my sense of the spiritual perfection of the moment. It doesn't distort my behavior. It doesn't become suffering. There's some things that are desirable about pain and some things that are undesirable. You start to see very clearly when you experience the pain without the resistance, you get all the desirable things and less of the undesirable things. Insight arises from direct experience, but you have to be able to make discernments. Without carefully observing, you can't see the difference. What does a microscope do? A microscope allows one to make distinctions. Vipassana, discernment, distinctions. Without the resolution power of the mindfulness, you don't experience the pain and resistance as two separate phenomena. You experience them together as an experience of suffering. When you look with the microscope of mindfulness, you're able to discern or see very clearly. Time and space get separated out, and you can see the pain arising before any resistance arises. And it doesn't cause suffering. It's part of the effortless flow of nature. And then as it's arising, some resistance starts to take place. The body tenses, the mind judges. And lo and behold, at that very instant, that pain turns into a problem. And before it wasn't. Well, unless you can sort of slow down time and spread out space through the microscope of mindfulness. Mindfulness is really a time-space microscope. In fact, what mindfulness actually is like is it performs both the functions of a microscope and what's called an oscilloscope. A microscope spreads out space so we can make discriminations. An oscilloscope slows down time. Events that are happening at thousands of cycles per second are slowed down on the screen so you can see them in one or two cycles per second. A microscope gives you spatial resolution. An oscilloscope gives you temporal resolution. The mindfulness practice gives you both. You can slow down time enough to see the pain is now rising. Hey, it's no problem. It's just part of God. And now the body's tensing, the mind's judging. Oh, my God, it's suffering now. When those two come together, you actually see that directly over and over and over and over again. You see it with physical pain. You see it with emotional pain. You see it with intense pain. You see it with subtle pain. And having seen it in so many circumstances, in so many guises over and over and over again, eventually the insight becomes crystal clear. Suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance. And once that becomes crystal clear, your whole concept of pain changes. There are analogous insights that take place with pleasure, and so on. The clearer it becomes that suffering comes about when pain is greeted by interference with the natural movement of that pain, the clearer that concept becomes experientially, the more one tends to let go of that interference. Obviously, it's classical Skinnerian conditioning. An association is developed between interference with the natural flow of pain and exacerbation of the pain. And once that association is clearly established through mindfulness, there is what is called classical behaviorist conditioning or Skinnerian conditioning, which means that at the depths of one's being, where the habit of resistance starts, the habit of resistance gets trained away. the depths of one's being have the level of organization of a lizard or a worm. How do you train a lizard? How do you train a worm? You can't talk to it. You can't image it. You can't suggest things to it. But you can set up a situation where that lizard can make a clear correlation between a behavior and increased pain. In the same way, deep, deep down, where the interference starts, is a very primitive level of our being. People think that they can reach that level by imaging or by self-talk. No way. No way. It can only be reached in a much more primordial mode. As you are making this link, this correlation, that when the pain arises, when the resistance comes, the interference comes, the pain becomes a problem. Each time you observe that clearly, a message trickles down into the place where the resistance starts. And you have to observe over and over and over and over again for enough of those drops of clarity to trickle down into the murky depths of the subconscious so that the place where the habit of resistance starts can learn the lesson that it needs to learn. And it learns in its animal way, in that classical behaviorist reconditioning. So the mindfulness sets up the environment within which the primitive levels of the consciousness can be reprogrammed. So that's experiential learning. It's not enough just to understand it conceptually. It's not enough just to see it one or two times. One has to see it over and over and over again. So we might call this the trickle-down theory of purification. In a sense, there's nothing more to do but keep on infusing the feeling body with as much mindfulness and equanimity as we can. However, something that is very helpful in the process of doing that is to develop an intimacy with the modes in which feeling tend to move. As you're paying attention to sensations, you'll notice that they tend to shift shape a little bit, and that shifting can sometimes be in the mode of a stately undulation, maybe like a jellyfish moving or something like that. Sometimes there is rapid vibration. Sometimes the modes of moving are very abrupt. There's all sorts of ways in which the sensations tend to move. Sometimes there'll be an eruption in the primary area and then a kind of rippling and spreading out from that, almost like a splash and then a ripple. You come to realize that there's only a few basic modes of impermanence or change in these sensations. As you become intimate with these modes or movements or change types in your body sensation, you learn how to yield to them, how to go with them. That is equivalent to dropping the resistance to the natural movement of the sensation. So that's very, very helpful. Sometimes the sensations seem to be absolutely still and stable. They seem to show no impermanence whatsoever. They seem solid and permanent. What to do then? There doesn't seem to be any movement quality to sort of flow with. Well, what to do then is just accept the stillness and stability of the sensation. That's its movement quality. It has zero movement quality, or it has the movement quality of zero velocity. There is, after all, a zero on the speedometer. That is a speed, and a legitimate speed. However, if a sensation seems not to change at all, that situation may come about in two rather different ways. The stability of the sensation may have a quality of lightness and peacefulness. It's not moving because everything is balanced. And in that case, you can focus in on that quality of lightness and peacefulness and stillness and tranquility and sort of internalize that and let that take you into deeper and deeper states of an eternal now, a timeless world, a still world. But typically, if a sensation doesn't move, it won't have such a pleasant quality of stillness and tranquility. It sometimes does. But typically, the sensations that don't show us any movement have quality of solidity and pressure associated with them. But there's something very interesting about pressure. When a sensation is solid and seems to have pressure forces, if you inquire carefully, you may be able to detect whether there may be an inward pulling force, there may be an outward pushing force, or there may be a simultaneous in and out force. Within the pressure, if you are able to detect one of these patterns, you can ask yourself, okay, the sensation is very solid, seems not to be moving, but does it seem to want to push out? Does it seem to want to pull in? Does it seem to want to go in both directions at the same time? Often, there will be an answer to that. And if you're able to detect that, then you yield to that. Wants to push out? You say, okay. Spread. Expand. Wants to pull in? You say, okay. Pull in. Grip. Collapse. Wants to do both at the same time? Okay. Do both at the same time. When you initially yield to those forces and give them permission, you may find that that exacerbates the sensation. And that's one of the little humps that you have to be willing to get over. The more it pulls in, the more intense it gets. Or as you give it permission to push out, it starts to spread and fill your whole body, and that can be frightening if it's a painful sensation. But if you're willing to accept such temporary worsenings, then the resistance starts to go away, and you realize that the fundamental forces of expansion and contraction are present even when things don't seem to move. They're present as pressure forces. And then when you yield to those pressure forces, they turn into movement and flow. The pleasure gives more fulfillment. The pain produces less suffering. In a sense, when we work with the feeling core of our being through body sensation, all we have to do is be as precise and allowing as possible in whatever way we can. But in another sense, it's extremely useful to be aware of some of the possibilities that will be there. Basically, a sensation is either stable or it's moving and changing in some way. There's no third possibility. If it's moving and changing in some way, get intimate with that movement and change and give yourself to it. If it's stable, ask yourself, is this a light and tranquil stability? No pressure? Fine. And just abide in that light and tranquil quality for as long or as short as it lasts. If there's pressure and solidity, then fine. But is that pressure caused by the fundamental force of the universe called contraction? Or is it caused by the fundamental force of the universe called expansion? Or is it caused by both being present simultaneously? Whatever the configuration is, detect it, yield to it, regardless of what the immediate consequences may seem to be. And once again, you are in contact with the fundamental nature of nature, which is impermanence. To be able to do this habitually is to have what we could call skill at feeling. And as that skill matures, you can do this and respond to the demands of life at exactly the same time. When you're able to do that, you have one of the most extraordinary tools that any human being can have. The sensations that arise or the feelings that arise, I use body sensation and feeling as exactly synonymous. They both correspond, as far as I'm concerned, to the Pali word vedana. These sensations or feelings that arise may arise from different causes. You can have the fear quality arise within you because somebody has a gun to your head, which is arising from an objective situation. Or you can have the exact same fear quality, same intensity, same quality, same spatial distribution, can arise at the thought of riding on an airplane where there is not an objective danger, but it still impacts on the body. The reality of the feeling is no different from if there was an objective situation. It is extremely useful to make feeling tangible by being able to observe it as body sensation. The reason that there's so much confusion between the thinking process and the feeling process, of course, is that these two arise intertwined. So to make it tangible, when one has an experience of anger, thoughts go through the mind. He said such and such. That's a memory. Okay. How dare he do such and such? That's a judgment. Next time he does such and such, I'm going to do such and such. That's a plan. But what I'd really like to do is such and such. That's probably going to be a fantasy. These are words happening in the internal speakers. And meanwhile, on the internal screen, there's a picture of such and such and doing such and such, et cetera, et cetera. That's all the thought part. And while that's going on, a tight quality is arising in the gut, a shaky quality is arising in the legs and spreading through the rest of the body, a hot quality is moving over the face and also spreading subtly over the rest of the body, a pressured quality is arising in the chest and also spreading over the rest of the body. And this is happening exactly simultaneously. Now, if our skills of mindfulness, our ability to discern the components of experience are highly developed, while this is going on, and indeed while we are reacting to the situation that's producing this, we can still be aware what part is thought, what part is feeling. We can keep track of these components. But if we don't have those skills of keeping track of the components, then we get this mixture, this tangling together of the feeling body and the thinking mind. The result of the tangling together can bring some very undesirable consequences. The undesirable consequences come about in two aspects. One is that there is an illusory intensification of the experience if it's a negative one like anger. Because the different strands, the different components of the experience don't just add together. They crisscross and multiply. So if you have 10 units of discomfort in the body and 10 units of negativity in the thoughts, what you actually have there is 10 plus 10 or 20 units of undesirable experience. That's what you actually have if you keep track of what's going on. If you don't keep track of what's going on, each of the 10 units of discomfort in the body interacts individually with each of the 10 units of negativity in the mind. They crisscross and multiply together to produce the illusion of 100 units of negativity. And all you have to do is now add a few more units, and I think you can see that very quickly you get an exponential runaway. Things get out of control very quickly. If you merely doubled, okay, and you have now 20 units of discomfort in the body and 20 units of negativity in the mind, if they multiply together, you now have 400 units of undesirable experience. Even though you only have 20 plus 20 or 40, you get the impression that you've got 400. If we can't keep track of these components, it very quickly gets out of hand and our suffering is vastly and unnecessarily exacerbated. Therefore, our response to the situation is going to eventually be distorted. This tangling together of the thinking process and the feeling process, on one hand, intensifies stuff unnecessarily, basically causes suffering that doesn't have to be there. Conversely, if we're able to keep track of it, we can just be with what is, and that may be much more manageable. The second effect of the tangling together of components is that it can actually produce the illusion of something being there that isn't even there to begin with. We all have a sense of self. That's undeniable. Every human being has a sense of self. If you look back very carefully and begin to question through which of the sense gates, there are only six senses, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and the thinking mind. Through which of the sense gates does this perception of myself arise? You'll see that it most assuredly arises from thought and feeling. Certain kinds of body sensations are more self-referential than others. The touch of your clothes is somewhat related to your sense of self, but the feelings that you might experience over your body when somebody criticizes you or praises you is much more related to the sense of self. They're both body sensations. The touch of your clothes is a body sensation. The feeling that you experience in your body when you are embarrassed in public or when you are praised in public, those are also absolutely body sensations. However, the latter body sensations are a bit more associated with our sense of individual existence or self. There's internal talking and especially internal imaging that is associated with our sense of who we are, what we look like, etc. The sense of self arises through certain thoughts and feelings, and there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with the arising of a sense of an individual self. However, if we are unable to be precise about the components of the experience of self-consciousness, then some undesirable results take place. We get an impression that there is something there which is not there. The sense of self is quite real and quite natural, but it is an activity of consciousness. It is a kind of doing. It is a flow of our personality. When we are unable to keep track of the components that constitute that sense of self, and they tangle together, we get a perception of self as a separate, vulnerable particle, rather than as an interactive, uninhibited wave of personality activity. And our language reflects the concept of self as thing and reinforces that. But our perception of self as thing, as opposed to self as activity, our perception of self as separate and vulnerable and a particle, originally comes about through the tangling together of thought and feeling. It's a kind of illusion. When thought and feeling become untangled through precise awareness, then we get a very different sense of self, a fundamentally different perception of what the self is. So originally, the thought and feeling gets tangled, it produces the sense of self as a separate particle, and then that gets reflected in human language and reinforced in every sentence that we speak thousands and thousands of times a day. Because in all human languages that I'm familiar with, including the languages of ancient world, including the languages of Native Americans, including African languages, every language that I've ever studied has the duality of subject and object built into it. In other words, it has the particulate self paradigm built into it. I can't talk about this without saying I. And every time I say the pronoun I, it reinforces a sense of a thing called I, as opposed to an activity called I that is linked to all other activities in the universe.